You're listening to The Art of Imperfect Adulting. I'm your host, Amy Stone. Here, I share stories from real people navigating the adventure that I call adulting. Are you ready? Me too. Let's do this. Hello, friends. In this episode, I'm going to introduce you to Mark Steven Porro, and we talk about his relationship with his mom. More to the point, we talk about how he made the decision to step in as a full-time caregiver for her in the last years of her life. Mark is a talker, he's a storyteller, and he's probably got endless stories about his mom. He shares a lot in this interview. You're going to love it. I've had the pleasure to share a few caregiving stories already on this show, but it's not every day that I get to tell the story of a son who steps into the role of caregiver. So now, if you're ready, I'm ready. Let's go. Mark Steven Porro, welcome to The Art of Imperfect Adulting. Are you ready for a fun chat?
I certainly am. And so thank you for having me.
Oh, so happy you're here. So I usually start with the same question for everybody. What part of the world do you call home?
I live in a little village in the south of France called Pézenas, which is just a very cool, very artsy 16th century. There's some places are a lot older. My place that you're seeing in the background is almost 500 years old. And I visited here in 2015 for 5 days and fell in love with the village and the people and said, this will be my home. And so I moved a couple of years later.
That is absolutely the best answer I've ever gotten. All the 90 times I've asked that question, I love that answer. You also, I think you have maybe the best Wi-Fi for anybody who's living in a 500-year-old space that I've talked to.
Well, I tell people they can come and share the comforts of King Louis XIV, but with modern day. So we have actually fiber here.
You have fiber.
I don't think Louis had that, but we have fiber here. So it's quite good. It's also in the middle of the largest wine growing region in the world. So if you're into wine, it's great. If you're not, it's a frickin' nightmare.
We did a family trip several years ago, and we went through Germany and up into Amsterdam. That was the family trip. And we stayed in a castle for one of the stops, which I thought was a Schloss, which I thought would be a lot of fun to stay in a castle. Not surprisingly, though, the medieval castle had terrible Wi-Fi, and it was the first place we stopped. And my teenage travel companions were very unhappy about that.
I'm sure. Yeah.
Very
the walls,
unhappy.
You know, it's interesting. So the walls are very thick. They're about 32 centimeters thick. But the ceilings are, I can hear, there's one apartment above me in this building, and I hear everything. So the floors are like micro thin, yet the walls are thick. So the walls are the problem with the Wi-Fi. But with the fiber, I'm very fortunate here. It's good.
Very nice. All right. So in a second, we're going to start the official conversation, which is not about Wi-Fi and castles. But I want to ask one more warm-up question. Can you share with me in the audience something that's a hobby or a pastime or a passion that isn't work or family?
Well, I'd have to say my attempt at learning the French language, because I came here without knowing any French. And but we have French on my mom's side. My mom's parents both passed before she was married, so we didn't really know my grandmother or my great-grandmother, who actually married a Frenchman. And so I think my French ancestors helped pave the way here. So, and my girlfriend is fluent in French, and she's Swiss French. And so I have to learn a language. So I wouldn't quite say it's a passion. It should be. I should work harder. But the people here are so kind, and they apologize for their bad English. And so I really think my goal here is to help them with their English more so than they help me with my French.
What's the toughest thing you've tried to do in French?
Speak.
I can understand
quite a bit. They speak very fast.
They drive very fast also,
but they speak very fast, like we do as Americans. You just go, and in the South, it's also like America. They have a very distinct accent, and the French that I've learned is through, I'm sure, Parisian accent.
Oh, so yeah.
And
yeah.
so a lot of times they have no idea what I'm saying, even though I'm speaking French. The pronunciation isn't correct for them. And they're lovely, but I see them as soon as they hear the accent, they turn off.
They turn off and say, "Can we speak English to you?" Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly. All right. So now to get to the topic of the day, which is the relationship with you and your mom, caregiving for your mom. Are you ready to talk about that?
Sure.
I know. I think you've talked about this a lot, so I'm excited to hear it. So the end of this story, the point of the story is the caregiving relationship with you and your mom. But I want to back up a little bit and before we do that and talk a little bit about your earlier concept when you were younger about caregiving in your family. Like talk about your grandparents and so on and so forth. When you were growing up, do you feel like you had a culture of the kids should take care of their parents when they got older?
I guess I only had one grandparent. My mother's parents died before she was married. My grandfather died when I was maybe 1 years old. So all I had was my grandma on my dad's side, and she was great. And we went quite often to grandma's house. She lived in Floral Park, Long Island, and we lived in New Jersey. So it was an hour, maybe hour and a half trip, but we went quite often. My father was the second son. And so I learned, that she was a valuable part of the family, and I enjoyed it. Her daughter, who never married, lived with her and was like her caregiver. And early on, Aunt Flo and I did not get along very well. I was scooted out of the house quite often with the broom, but later on, we actually became really, really like pals.
Okay.
Again, a very cool lady, and I respect that she stuck around and took care of her mother until her mother went into a nursing home, probably around age 90. And but we grew up in a very strict Catholic family, and you learn to care for others.
Okay.
And I saw both of my parents. They taught us, I think, more by example than telling us what to do. We watched. My dad had great manners, and when a lady walked into the room, he stood up
Okay.
and opened the door for the ladies all the time. And I do this, and I tell people chivalry is not dead. My mother, I never heard I think an ill word about anybody from her, and she cared especially for animals. We had a lot of animals in the family. I mean, a ton of animals. And even the I have a chapter in the book about these two mice. She bought two mice for my older brother, and one of them, after mouse years, is about, I think, a 2 year lifespan. One was looked like she was on her way out, and so my brother said, because I wasn't I think even around for this, he said that he watched this woman stay up all night trying to nurture this mouse back to good health. And she did. And the mouse lived for at least a couple more mouse years and produced tons
Wow.
more mice. And that was his first impression of how much my mom cared about animals in particular, but the smallest ones. And she proved that my whole life, because whenever we had animals or pets, and we sometimes you become a little more neglectful as a teenager, especially. And
Yes.
mom took them all on.
That's the role of the family, right? Like, but yes, I've given many lectures in my house about if we're going to adopt the pets, you guys have to take care of them. And it always falls back to the parents at some point or another, more or
Right.
less. And there are a few pets where I was like, listen, this one is off the table because I am not going to step in. Like, so the kids wanted snakes and things like that. And I was like, I have nothing against snakes. I just know myself. I don't want to get in there and clean the cage and hunt it up. So I got to say no. Gotta say no because you gotta be able to help. All right, so you had an example of a family member stepping in to care for somebody older than them, and that's part of the story then. And then you talk about siblings. How many siblings do you have?
There are five siblings. So I have two older brothers, two older sisters, and one younger sister.
So you're the second to youngest.
Second, the youngest, and the tallest. So
Okay.
that is something to do. Because I still have some payback. My two older brothers, boy, they did a lot of stuff to me. When writing this book, I discovered even more that was, I think, hidden in my deep recesses of my memory. But payback is coming.
That's so
And
funny.
maybe writing the book was part of that.
It's so funny that those wounds, those relationships stay the same no matter how old we get. It's like I'm the tallest. Like this is where it is. Absolutely. All right. So You shared with me on the intake form that when you finally made the switch to care for your mom, you were living a carefree bachelor life. That's how you describe it.
Yep.
Take a minute and tell us a little bit about what your life was like before this big shift.
Well, I in 84 I gave up a really good design career. Not totally, but the acting bug, I caught the acting bug, and part of that was mom's fault. She introduced us to the arts early on in our lives, and we traveled to New York and to see Broadway plays and the ballet and Lincoln Center and Radio City Music Hall and all that kind of stuff. And then all of us took ballet as kids, and we performed and all that stuff. But so I kind of buried that for a while because I wanted to go to medical school.
Okay.
And in college, I switched over to industrial design because I still had a strong creative side. And industrial design, I was very fortunate, married all my I guess passions at the time, which was math and science and art. And Ohio State is where I went. I'm wearing the shirt now. They
We can
had
still be
one of the
friends, but I
best.
have a kid that goes to Michigan.
Okay, that's a we're okay. I'm
We can
okay.
still be
I'm not
friends.
that crazy kind of fan, but boy, it exists.
It does. It does. That is the
And
rivalry. Yeah.
Michigan's a great school.
Yeah.
We won't talk about their football, but asterisk next to their championship, and there's none with us. But okay, moving on. I got a lovely degree, and I worked for a couple of really good design firms, and then this acting bug bit me again. And so I moved out to LA and enjoyed that life for 28 years. I started some companies. I jokingly call them nonprofits because I was a bit of an entrepreneur, serial or whatever, and some of those didn't work out, but I learned from each adventure. While pursuing the acting the whole time. But I was never married, had no children, and California was great. And
So
then,
you were living in California when this sort of shifted.
So I had a really good relationship with both of my folks. And my father passed about 14 years earlier. And so my mom was alone in the house that we are at this point, where we all grew up. And we had some people who moved in upstairs that were supposed to oversee the house and the household duties and do shopping and stuff for mom. Mom could still take care of herself, but she was no longer driving and things like that. But she got to a point after her 80, this event that was the catalyst, right after her 89th birthday, she suffered from depression throughout her life, but hid it very well from us. And I didn't know how deep it got. But at this point, I think she looked around and said, "Boy, if this is my life, I'm out of here. I'm not happy." She had two sons that lived close, and my other sister lived at the Jersey Shore, not far away. But the main people in her life at that point were these people she did not get along with. And so she kind of, I think, willed herself to death. So she was, as the doctor cut off all meds and called hospice. And my brother said, I put mom to bed and she's not responding to anything. And so I called it a semi-comatose state. So I flew in the next day and all the kids came home.
Because you
And
thought this was the end.
we were on
Yeah.
death watch.
Yeah.
And hospice was there. And then at one point, shortly after that, we had a priest come in and deliver the last rites. And my younger sister and I picked out a nice eco-friendly coffin. The rest of the funeral arrangements were set with my brother, who handled all the family finances and I think those particular things. And so, yeah, it was a bit scary, but hospice was great. These people in the house, I didn't really care for them either, but hospice was on duty. And so my younger sister and I hung out with hospice because we wanted to learn how to take care of our mother for as long as she was going to be with us. We wanted to be there and be hands-on. And they were very generous, teaching us how to, the sponge bathe and change the diapers and change the bedding with a helpless patient in bed. And at that point, my mother had some bed sores and how to treat those. And it was great because I think after a few weeks, again, no food, a little moisture on her lips, and that was it, and no meds. Mom snapped out of it. And I think that she, I have a chapter in the book called A Silent Scream. And I think it was a cry for help. She wanted love back into her house and certainly back into her life. And with all her kids there, I think she kind of felt that. So when she woke up, while I was there and she was, you know, not really responsive, I looked around and this was no longer the loving home that we all grew up in. And most of my mother's things were sequestered in her bedroom. All the things that were throughout the house that were Poro items and stuff were all stuffed into her room. And these people really kind of took over the home. And as I took all that stuff in, I said, my mom deserves better. And okay. So I stayed with her for several weeks after she woke up from this. And then I, when I felt comfortable enough to go back to LA, because I had a business. At this point, I had a business that was actually doing pretty well. My brother and I started a snack food business to honor my dad and his invention of this half popcorn snack. So I had a factory in LA. And
wow, okay.
But I was able to go back and produce enough to handle, because our business at that point was slowing down a little bit. We were a national brand and we had national distribution, but things were happening where things were about to slow down. So the timing, whether mom had something to do with it, I don't know, but the timing was perfect to, like, okay, I can let this dwindle a little bit because mom's more important. And so hospice, at least in New Jersey, when they are called, they stay for 6 months maximum. Okay. So I knew they were going to be on for at least a couple more months. So I felt comfortable that even though the people were still in the house doing what they did, I could go back to LA, and I kept in touch with mom. And at that point, she had an iPad so we could do video calling and stuff like that. And then September, I came back, and my nephew was getting married at the Jersey Shore. So I told the people who were there, I'm taking over again for these next 2 weeks, so relax. And I treated her like a queen, and she loved it. And, okay. You know, growing up with three sisters, I learned, they all had long hair. So I learned how to take care of mom's hair and doll her up. And being a son, I think you can, at least I did, I took maybe a little more romantic approach to taking care of mom. And so during that time at the wedding, it was her first time out since this near death thing, like six months earlier. And she was the belle of the ball. She just loved it. And we got her dolled up with the lipstick and I had her hair. Her hair was long again, which was lovely because most of the, after having six kids, it went from long to
short.
A perm.
Yes.
And, yeah. So during that, those 2 weeks in September, I asked her if she wanted me to come back and make sure she was treated like this the rest of her life. And she said yes.
And so let's go back and cover a couple of those things so that they don't get lost, because I think there's a lot of information in there that people might be interested in. So she was widowed for over a decade before this started.
14 years. Yeah, yeah.
And so she was living alone. I think that everybody who's not living under a rock probably knows that, you know, loneliness and isolation as you age and as you lose, you know, mobility and community, that's a definite issue. So it sounds like you guys had brought people into the house to sort of pick up on the things that she needed done.
And keep her company.
So like companions and do the things around the house that needed to be done. How close, there's two brothers that you said that were close. How close were they to the house?
Well, my oldest brother is 6 years older, and he handled, again, all the finances, and he would visit my mother probably twice a day.
Okay, so
in the
very
morning,
close.
He would help her and distribute the medications at that point. That point, you know, in the U.S. medical system, she probably had a dozen medications. So he ordered all those and divvied those up on what, you know, every day you have those boxes for Monday through Sunday. So he was very good, and it was a lot of pressure because he did the hiring of all these people. This was the third group that we had in that house.
Right.
So at this point, it was probably about 4 or 5 years she was back in the home. She did go to assisted living before that.
Okay.
For a few years, and that was an adjustment, but she liked it because she was very social.
Okay.
And she had a dog, and they allowed her to have the dog. She had her own apartment, and so the social was very important that she had there. But her dog, there was a biting incident.
Okay.
Get a ruined part of the book. And so they said, the dog goes. And she says, if the dog goes, I go.
So that's how she ended up back at home,
Right.
and it
And
was
luckily, we still
definitely,
had the family home and it
yeah.
was still livable, but it needed some work. So actually, I flew back. I have a lot of experience with construction and design stuff. So I worked on the house to get it back up to livability. It was okay, it was close. But then I also built an apartment upstairs for these people who were going to come in.
Okay, so
And
you did that, and so you brought in people to do that. I want to ask a little bit about this, like was this just age, or was there anything else going on? Like, was there memory stuff like dementia, Alzheimer's, or
yeah, she
just
had a little
age?
bit of that.
Okay.
In fact, well, there's a chapter in a book about that too, because a couple of months in, so I'm when I took over the 24/7 care, which was later that year, I'm the only one of the six kids that she couldn't remember the name of,
Okay.
and I'm the one wiping her butt several times a day. So I have a chapter in the book, Does Wiping Butt Cause Amnesia?
I looked through parts of the thing and I saw something. I was like, I
I have
wonder
scientific evidence that, in fact, it does. And
if
but you know, that was one of the things I learned. You can't take any of this stuff personally, because I
Okay.
knew she loved all her kids, and but she had a wicked sense of humor. So one morning, this is a couple months in, I go in. The morning routine would be I'd wake her up and give her some juice in a sippy cup. And she would say, good morning. She goes, now, what is it I call you? And I said, you're kidding, right? And she says, no. I said,
Yeah.
name your kids. And she says, Laurel, Michael, Carol, David, DC. And stumped. And
Just
I
it
said,
just
Mark.
gone.
And I thought, oh, I have her. She goes, oh, Mark. And I said, then she says, oh, Mark with a K? I said, yes, you named me. And she goes, oh, okay. And I said, I'm your favorite son. She goes, I don't have a favorite. I said, well, you have a favorite to forget.
That would be That could be hard not to take personally. Could be tough not to take personally. Absolutely. So
But
I
you gotta.
try not to like ask my guests to tell stories of other people, but I am going to break that rule a little bit here because I would love for you to share like a little bit because you've laid out some of the ways that you were caring for her. But what was her life like, sort of before without you before you stepped in as a caregiver? What was her daily routine, and then how did it maybe shift when you came in as a 24/7 caregiver?
Okay, so at that point, we had someone helping her with her personal hygiene
Okay.
because she couldn't get up and easily, let's say, get to the bathroom and things like that. So we had a nurse's aide come in the morning and get her ready, because she would go to a senior center, again, for the social and to keep active several times a week. So this person would come in and get her ready to go to the senior center. So mom would spend most of the day at the senior center and then come back. She ate breakfast at home. I assume she ate lunch at the senior center. And then she came back and had dinner. These people would give her dinner, and she would sit in the living room in a cushy chair and watch Wheel of Fortune and Jeopardy.
Yeah, as one does.
Mom was a proofreader for the largest newspaper in New Jersey. So words and all that stuff was a big
Okay.
deal for her, spelling. And then also the Animal Planet. If she could watch the Animal Planet 24/7, I think she would be totally happy. And then the nurse's aide would get her ready for bed at night, and she'd get to probably in bed by 8 o'clock. And that was pretty much it. And that was the routine. I guess when I came in, the first thing I did was she had these drab night dresses and day dresses and looked like an old lady. And I'm like, you know, especially with three sisters and stuff, I said, come on. So I said, the first thing I wanted to do is return some dignity to her. So I bought her a new wardrobe. That was the main thing. And I said, you want to cheer anybody up at any age, especially a woman. A new wardrobe will do that.
Okay.
So that was a challenging thing because you have a middle-aged guy looking for nightwear for a woman in the malls. It was a little freaky and stuff. So I eventually got those online, and then I tried to treat her like a queen. One of the really interesting things, though, so our adventure lasted 3.5 years.
Okay, so you were full time 3.5 years.
Well, 3.5 years for this adventure. So I didn't, when this thing happened, this near death thing happened in February, I didn't move back full time until December of that year.
Okay.
And so the whole time in the book, the time frame is 3.5 years. But mom was almost completely med free that whole time. So all those medications she was taking, she didn't need any of those. She needed digoxin because she had a pacemaker. And so digoxin was, I think, the only medicine really that she took after that.
So after hospice left, you guys went worked with the doctors and got just took all those medicines off. She just never went back on them.
Right.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
So how did you make the decision? So you went to the family wedding, you talked to your mom, you said, "Would you like me to be there?" From your side, what were the things going through your head that were like, I want to be there for my mom 24/7. I want to be the person who's there." How did you make that decision to move home?
Well, the decision was easy. My mom deserved better.
Okay.
And at that point, I knew I had to step up because with my older brother doing what he was doing, so visiting twice a day and hiring these people, and when we would come in to visit mom, we would say, "Hey, these people aren't great." And my brother would say, "Great, what are you going to do about it?"
Right,
Because,
please help.
yeah, it was a lot on his shoulder. So one of the reasons was, to take some of the work off his shoulders. And she always took care of us.
Yeah.
I never felt like a mom wavered with me, and I had a pretty interesting upbringing and stuff like that. Whenever I did any bad things, it wasn't like, you're out of here or whatever. So mom was always there for us. And I grew up in this family that we took care of ourselves, or each other. And it was important. And it made me feel good to
Okay.
see her. I said the first thing when I asked her that permission discussion, I said, "If I do this, two things. First of all, we're going to have fun, because that's my approach." And she was a funny lady, and she was game. And second of all, it means if you trust me, and she said yes, I said, "I will protect you and make sure you stay healthy and safe for the rest of your life." And she said, "Great." And I said, "But that means I'm in charge."
Yep,
And her
and
mood completely changed.
how did it change?
Yeah. Well, because I'm now in charge, I said, "You must now obey me."
And did she like that? Did she laugh,
Well,
or was
she
she was like,
puckered,
I don't
she
know?
looked me straight in the eye. It was not like, "Oh yes," it was like, but she puckered up for a kiss, and I knew her at that point, so I wasn't sure if that was one saying yes or one saying, "I'm wishing you luck, good luck," because she could be a tough cookie. So I gave her a
Well,
kiss and hoped for the best, and
there you go.
yeah.
So, what were the first big changes and challenges that you came across when you took this on as a full-time role?
Yeah. Well, it happened originally with the hospice, and especially for a son. I'm seeing my mother naked for the first time.
Fair enough.
And at that point, she's 89 years old.
Yeah.
And but if I was going to, and this is, I think, where my acting came in, I'm assuming that role of now the caregiver. I had to get over it and get on with it, because this is my job, or the job I was about to take on. And you're seeing what the years have done to your mother, and gravity is not kind. And she had open heart surgery years earlier, and now she has a pacemaker. And that was a bit of an adjustment. And then I won't go into it, but we have some other stuff in the book, the things that I had to do. There was no line that I did not cross to make her life better.
All right.
And these
Very.
attempts, and I learned again a lot from hospice in the beginning, and I did some research on my own and things like that. But Yeah, I think that was the main thing. This
That
is no
would be,
longer, it's still my mom, but she's my patient at this point.
Yeah, that
And
would be
I've
an
got to do what's
adjustment.
best for her, but also treat her with, you know, dignity and still your mom. So
It's like a completely different redefinition of the roles and identities within your family, which, I mean, those happen. We shake those up, but with a famous shift for that role, the shift is when like the kids shift from being children to being adults. And sometimes parents really struggle with like adolescence and young adult. That, but we don't, the next one is what you went through, which is the reverse, which is like stepping in as the caregiver for somebody who was your adult. And it's that those are always hard within a family to redefine those things for sure. All right. So you stepped in as support for your mom. Who is supporting you at this time? Because caregiver support is a big thing, it's exhausting.
So let's say when hospice was there, my younger sister and I were very hands-on. And then we taught some of those tips and tricks we learned from hospice to my older brother and oldest sister. The two middle kids were hands-off.
Okay.
They were not comfortable at all. They helped in other ways. And I would have to say one of the things I learned, you've got to find what your wheelhouse is and be comfortable. Or fake it really well because you don't want your loved one or your patient to feel that because they'll feel guilty and that'll cause issues. So even if I had some emotional issue, I would get out of the room. I didn't want my mom to see that or experience that at all. I wanted her to know that here we are. And we had some rough times and we had, so I had to get over that. But I would say whenever my younger sister came in to visit, she had five kids. She lived in Michigan. She had a business. And when she would come in, she would help. She would jump right back in and be hands-on. My brother Michael kept in, we called it kept in practice. He would come every Tuesday. I mean, he would visit quite often, it's still, but he would come in on Tuesday nights and cook and get mom ready for bed at night.
Okay.
So he did the sponge bathing and all that stuff. So in case I needed help, he would be able to jump in and stay in practice. And then when I had to go every few months, I had to go back out to LA for the snack food company. My sister, who also lived in California, would fly in and substitute for me. So we always had a family member on duty.
So
And
you
so
were
that.
juggling all these things. So I was going to ask you, because so you did not completely shut down everything in LA when you moved home.
Right.
Yeah, you see, so you were doing the whole
We let
bi-coastal
it we
thing.
let it kind of peter out, but yeah, because I wasn't aggressively marketing it or any of that kind of stuff still. I
But you
had to
still
stay.
had one foot in it, like things going on, connections. That's okay. So that's, and it sounds like your family all, like you guys circled the wagons and everybody did their part. So you were not unsupported. You had a pretty good family support
We're
network.
very lucky because I've heard horror stories, you
It
know.
can be, I think it can be really hard. I can think it'd be really hard. So one of the things that you mentioned in the intake form, which I think is absolutely true, is that you don't often hear about the primary caregiver in these situations being a son. Or and especially if you've got, I mean, this is generalized in some circles, not circles I tend to hang out in as often as it very much as women's work, right? Like taking care of the babies, taking care of those. And you had sisters, but you stepped up to do this. And so, what are some, so seeing your mom naked, shifting to her, thinking of her as a patient, so on and so forth, were there any things that came up with, you know, when you showed up as the caregiver? Like, what were the other surprises that popped up?
There were a couple of funny. Again, mom was funny. We had some funny conversations, and part of that was a little bit of her dementia and stuff. But I would have to say, I gave her sponge baths in the morning and night, and it was quite a routine I had to go through, especially at night, to get her ready because the next time it might be 12 hours before she's getting up
Right.
and changing a diaper and stuff like that. So I'm just about to finish. Taping the diaper and she starts peeing on me. Now that's cute if you're a brand new mother and your infant
It's
is peeing
not
on
even
you.
cute then.
Okay, well, it's cuter than this. So
Yes, I'll give you that.
mom's peeing on me and I just, oh mom, why? I just about finished. And she
Yeah.
says, it's natural. And you go, how can you be mad? I mean, it's
So
just
good.
like you gotta. You have to, and part of that, whether it's my acting, and certainly my upbringing, had something that you just got to roll with it, you
Yeah, I
know.
mean, it is definitely natural. I don't know. Diapers are not great. Like one of my jokes about parenting is, and I've never is that, nobody complains about the last diaper you changed. You're just like, thank goodness. Like, this is something we're happy to say goodbye to, and then
Frame
it
that.
comes, right? All
Well,
done. You know, that is a milestone we're happy to pass through. You know, we don't with goodbye diapers. So, that is, you are a trooper, absolutely. So, in a minute, we're going to do the final fun questions, but you did write a book about this, and I want
Right.
to give you a chance to tell people directly about the book and all the things.
Okay. So the book is titled A Cup of Tea on the Commode. And at this point, it was no longer really safe for mom to try to get in and out of the bathroom. So we had a commode bedside. And sometimes Mother Nature took a little longer than was comfortable for either one of us. And so her favorite beverage was a cup of hot tea, skim milk, and no sugar. And I kind of as a joke, I just said, "Would you like a cup of tea while we're waiting?" And she said, "Sure." So I made her a cup of tea and it became a hit. She loved it, and I said, okay. And then when I was writing the book, that came out of just a practical thing. I said, that's a great title. And most people think so. There's a few
I think
people
it's
like,
very
oh,
cute,
what are
yeah.
you going to? Anyway, so and while I was doing this, I felt my whether it's my unique approach or what, being a son, I had some friends being baby boomers that were going through a similar thing. And one of my friends called, and I started sharing some of the things I was doing, and she got some benefit out of it. And I said, I think I got something here. And I always wrote. I wrote in Hollywood, and I used to stand up, and I always took notes. And I wasn't sure what I was going to do with it, but I took extensive notes this whole time, and photographs and videos. And I did that with my dad too. My dad passed. I only had 8 days with him, but I knew I wanted to record this family moment. Or this family history, so the others, it wouldn't be lost, let's say, with Uncle Mark or Mark or whatever. So especially with mom, since we had such a long time, I was privy to some interesting conversations and some funny things and some sad things. And I wanted not only to record the family history, but I thought some people could get something out of it. And so that was the gist of the book. And I wrote screenplays and movies and stuff like that, but I've never written a book before, especially a memoir. So I knew that was going to be the genre. So I started studying it. And I did that after I moved to France because I needed some emotional distance. I'm a
Sure.
crybaby and I couldn't tackle this. But I had the notes, and whenever I felt I had something that was important, I would jot down the notes. And then after a year or so here, I really started knuckling down and I started studying. With a memoir coach, and got to a point where I felt pretty comfortable, and did a few drafts, and I found a publisher that it resonated with, and that was very rare, especially
Yeah.
in your 60s, to get a publisher, and they've been great, and the book is resonating with lots of people, and the notes I've gotten, I mean, another award came on Easter. So it's 16 literary awards, which is kind of cool. But the personal notes that I've received from people through Facebook and on Amazon and stuff like that, it's just been amazing. You have no idea, you put your heart and soul in something, you don't know if it's going to
You
resonate.
never know, yeah.
Yeah,
Yeah,
and
so they
it is, and it's been a blast, and it's been very steady. We had it released on Mother's Day in 2023, and the sales continue to be very steady, and people want to do these interviews, which is lovely. And it's cool because I keep telling stories about my mom, and it keeps her in the present. So this is your gift to me to be able to
absolutely.
share those stories. So it's lovely.
Absolutely. So I was looking it up. I didn't know if it was a memory thing or if it was just aging when I was writing out the interview, but I did look it up because this is something that more and more people are going to go through. It is a generational thing, which is very interesting. So like Your parents did less of it than your generation is doing, and then my generation is likely to do more. There are estimated to be worldwide 50 million adults who are going through memory loss and dementia and are getting what we call elder care. And in the United States, we call it unpaid elder care because it's families and friends and so on and
Right.
so forth. And that's estimated to double in the next 20 years. So these stories about how we're stepping into this and how we're taking into people, taking care of the people we love, are probably more and more important as we go, because
Yeah.
we don't all have them. We don't all have
Yeah.
them. And even if we did, even if when we were young, we saw people taking care of other people. I don't know about you, when I was 10 or 11, I wasn't paying attention.
Right. Yeah.
I wasn't paying attention. So
Yeah.
the name of the book is A Cup of Tea on the Commode, My Multitasking Adventures of Caring for Mom and How I Survived to Tell the Tale. You've offered to send out a couple of PDF copies for the people who sign up on your website. So we'll put the
Right.
link to that in the show notes and in the email that goes to all of the subscribers, which is the very best, easiest way for people to get the links with any podcast.
Right.
Join my community and get those emails. Zip, zap, zoom. Mark, are you ready for the final questions? The rapid fire, just for fun questions?
Oh, I guess so. I'll tell you after.
Don't be scared. All right.
No.
Do you these days have a set morning routine, and what is it?
Waking up, stretching
Okay.
and getting out of bed. It's funny because now I'm getting up earlier, but I went through a phase when I first met my girlfriend. I had, and there's a chapter in the book about this. My mom actually almost outlived me
Oh.
because of the stress and stuff. So, being a guy, I kind of resisted all the tips from hospice, take breaks. And so after that, I had three major surgeries. After those surgeries, I said, you know what? I'm going to let my body tell me
Okay.
when to wake up and things like that. So I said my Native American name was Up at 10. So I would get up at 10. And it's sometimes earlier, sometimes later, but I let my body tell me when. So that's the routine. I let, I, you know, because, yeah.
That's very good. That's very good. All right, very good. All right, so you wrote a book. Do you also listen to books or read books? And if so, do you want to share something that you recently read or listened to?
Well, I do both. I have to say I'm not a great reader. I have to admit, now I'm an author. I cannot tell you a book I read in high school, to be
Okay.
honest. Isn't that funny? I have some favorite books that I love. Well, once I became an adult, I started reading a lot. So I've tried to make up for it. But there, I'm trying to think of what was recent. There was a male blonde joke I read, which was kind of funny because you always hear the woman blonde jokes. Want me to tell you
Okay.
that one? That'll be
No, I think
recent.
we're gonna skip that.
Okay. It's
We're gonna
not
skip
bad, but
that.
okay.
Okay. All right. It could be. All right, very good. So now you live in a place where many people would consider vacation. Do you still take vacations? And if so, are you like doing local vacations in France, or are you still doing like travel the world, go exotic places?
I have been on vacation since I've moved here, to be
Okay.
honest. But
Okay.
you're in Europe, so you're close. I've been to Spain. I was in London for the London Book Fair a few weeks back.
Very nice.
My girlfriend is Swiss, so we go to Switzerland quite a bit. And then where we go in Switzerland is about 5 minutes from Germany. And my grandmother was German, so we go to Germany. So and I've been to Italy. I took a trip, actually. I took my dad to Italy to the village where his father came from 100 years earlier from
Wow.
when so I made there's a documentary about that also, and there'll be more. There is a chapter in the book, my mom's book. I'm also writing the next book is more about my dad. But we went to this little village when my dad turned 80. I gave it to him for a birthday gift and shot a documentary of it, and it was just an unbelievable trip. It was just the two of us. And he was suffering from heart disease at the time, but he was a tough cookie and he kind of hid it and muscled through it. And we just had a blast because the house is still there where his father was born. And his grandfather was the mayor of this village. And there was some rumor, I don't want to ruin it, I'll have to read the book, about why he left. Because he was the mayor, and apparently there were some shenanigans going on, and that's why he came to America. And
The
we found
scandal.
out that, in fact, was not true. And
Well, that's fun.
he's hailed as a hero, and we wouldn't have found that out if we didn't get to that village. In fact, it was
Wow.
only 200 people at the time. Now it's less than 100. And it was, I've got a picture of my dad knocking on his father's door.
Oh
And
my gosh.
it was just amazing. And
And so, and you turned that into a film documentary?
it's a documentary that's actually on a cup of tea on the, if they Google a cup of tea on the commode, we're everywhere.
It comes
But a
up.
cup of tea on the commode.org is the website. And there's a section called bonus materials. And in that, I actually have the, well, if they look it up, it's Chow Chella. It's on YouTube. But the documentary is on that bonus page, which is a lot of other things that we mentioned in the book that people may be interested in. So I added some poems and memory books and photographs that we talk about in the book. And so this thing was great because I did the trip, and we went all over Italy at that point. We spent 16 days together. And again, that might have been my first caretaking experience because my dad's life was in my hands. He was
Yeah.
not doing well. And one brother even said, we never expected him to come back. And I said, it would have been nice to tell me how bad things were. They didn't. They kept it from me.
It's hard. It's hard to, share that information in family. So they should have, but it can be really hard. That's really impressive. Like, so you turned one, you're writing the books, you've got the documentary. There's probably many other things I could talk to you about and go on and on forever, but I'm going to call it. That's it, Mark. Thank you so much for being an excellent guest today on the show.
Thank you, my pleasure.
Thank you for listening today. I hope that you enjoy the show. And before I go, I want to encourage you to become a bigger part of the conversation. Obviously, subscribe wherever you're listening to the show. Listen to more episodes. That'd be great. Obvi again. Please write a review and tell your friends about the show. That truly is a great help for getting the show in front of new people. Okay, but more fun for you yourself, head over to imperfectadulting.com and join the email community. You'll get some free stuff right away, and that way you'll begin to get the emails about the podcast. This includes the links for the special offers from the guests, and it's the only way to get that. Also, if you aren't in the mood to listen, I actually include an article directly in those emails. Whee! Now, if you love this and you crave more time with me, Amy, as a coach, a mentor, or just adult to your adult, numero uno, check out The Village. If you have a story you want to share with the listeners, I'd love to hear from you. I have an open application. Just let me know you want it. And that's a wrap for today. Until next time, remember, the journey is the destination. Ralph Waldo Emerson said that, not me. Well, until just now, I did just say it. But what I want you to hear today is that if your adulting journey isn't going the way you expected, that may not mean that you're lost. It may just mean that you're on your way. This is Amy Stone, signing off. The Imperfect Adulting Podcast is created and produced by Amy Stone and Amy Says So. Anything expressed on this show is offered as entertainment, and the views of the guests may not always represent the ideas and viewpoints of the host. That's me. Amy does not intend or hold herself out to provide professional advice or recommendations of any kind. In the end, you and you alone need to make those kinds of decisions based on your personal and individual situation, needs, circumstances, and comfort level.